Hello, this is Max Winslow interviewing John Braylor. John is my neighbor. He's a very interesting community member, and I think you guys will like this. Thank you. Please enjoy.
Would you mind telling me a little bit about what you were like when you were my age?
You're how old?
14.
Well, I was a lot smaller. 14. Let's see. I was about that time, I think I escaped from the orphanage. No. I'd been out a while, so I was in high school. My father had his own business, divorced my mother, so I had total freedom all day long. I had no supervision from early on, so I was kind of a wild kid. Neighbors kind of, like today, feared me. I was making rockets and bombs and, blowing them up in the park, and very experimental. The area I lived in was in Chicago, and was in a high-scale neighborhood, but a nice neighborhood, kind of like this kind of a neighborhood, but no valleys. And had a friend. We'd go out and do things like I like to break into companies and just check out all their equipment. I love like micrometers and microscopes and machinery. I had gone through Prosser Vocational High School, so I had had machine shop, made a cannon that shot a half-inch cannon ball bearing about a block using a firecracker. Used to shoot that up and down my alley. Took electronic shop, so. And my favorite subject was physics, and the rest of high school I got through by making crossbows, slingshots, catapults, and things in my dad's shop. Otherwise my grades were like in grade school my grades were FFFU, which means fail, fail, fail. Unsatisfactory, so they wouldn't fail me in the last quarter so that they could pass me on to the next thing, poor victim, a teacher. I think I probably had some attention deficit disorders. I noticed I looked up on MapView the children's home I was in, and it was called Ulrich's Children's Home, as I recalled it. But when I looked it up on the MapView, it was described as Home for Troubling Children. So I was in that for like 5 years after my dad married another woman who pretty quickly decided she couldn't handle me. So me and my sister were put in that end of that. So that's kind of the year years. Well, no, by that time I was out. My dad said, I said, when are you going to get us out of here? Because I was getting about your age. And he said, well, as soon as she divorces me, I says, take me home. And it took me about 3 weeks before she sued for divorce.
That's very interesting. So I have another question. It's what part of school did you enjoy, if any?
I remember, I forget what they call it, where you're studying about the Santa Maria and, in people coming over to this country and things like that. And there was a project where everybody had to make something had physical to do with that age, and people were making models, Santa Maria's and all those ships were. And I put the cannon I had made up on the teacher's desk, and it was facing the table where all these ships were, and I didn't even realize I had put it in line with all these ships, but I had a half-inch ball bearing in there with a one-inch firecracker in there up through the wick hole, and I didn't notice him come in. And the first thing he does is he sits down and he goes, oh, this is cool, and he lights the wick and shattered about six of the ship's plastic ships and broke the window.
Oh.
Needless to say, he passed me on to the next grade.
Okay. What parts of...
Oh, actually, I took... So in addition to all the machine shops, I knew how, you know, machinery capable of making things are. I grew up from being a kid in my dad's cabinet shop. So from being under the saws, playing in the sawdust, to organizing, to making things in a totally tooled up cabinet shop, in a wood cabinet shop. And then took drafting. When I graduated, I got immediately taken up by Hanna Engineering, which is now Rex Chainbelt. Worked in their drafting department, designed, actually came up with a design for a double-ended piston hydraulic cylinders. They used to screw the, put the piston in between and screw the shafts in from both ends. And somebody that didn't know that would go to turn the nut off on the end and would unscrew it from the piston. And I said, you know, why not just do compression rings on either side of a piston slit on this thing? And then they had me actually come up with all the calculations as to how thick how big a groove, what kind of materials to use and things like that. I did all that. And then I got drafted.
Oh, okay, yes.
At about, I think I was about 19.
So how was getting drafted? How was the whole thing?
Well, I got a notice to show up for my medical examination, and I figured, okay, you know, you show up, they'll give you an exam, and a couple months later, they'll tell you whether they want you or not. And so I went through the exam, and they lined us all up and said, raise your right hand. I said, what's going on? He said, well, you're drafted. We're, you know, ready to ship you out. And I go, well, wait a minute, do we have any choice here? I said, I'm expected home for dinner, you know. They said, no, you're in. And I said, well, what am I in? And I said, well, you do have a choice, 2 years Army or 2 years Marine. And I went, you know, I says, you know, well, you know, I'll take the Army. And then I went, oh, wait a minute. And I'm the kind of person that in a group setting like that, I'm the only guy that asks questions. Nobody else has the balls to stand up. And I said, wait a minute, do we have any choice here? And he says, yeah, you got 2 years Army or 2 years Marines. I said, well, where's the Army boot camp? It was Fort Knox, Kentucky in November. A friend already had volunteered, my break-in buddy had volunteered, had frostbite already, almost lost a toe. And I said, well, where's the Marine Corps base? Where's the Marines training going to be? And they said, San Diego, which is, and so I went, Semper Fi. So I went in for 2 years. End of boot camp here in San Diego, and it was a year where they had this major 100-year flood, so it was like, you know, we were boating, we finished up, and they went, everybody that slept in this building is going to be a tank driver, everybody in this building is going to be artillery, everybody in this building is going to be a cook. Now, the one thing I loved about the Marines, the food was fantastic. The stuff was thrown into the pots, like the vegetables were thrown into the pots and then distributed before they got soft or anything. So it was always super fresh food. And I went in November, so you had like Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and that was always like steak, you know, steak and major, major good food.
Turkey.
Oh, yeah. It was like a feast. And I think I weighed like 98 or 99 pounds when I joined.
Oh, wow.
When I got drafted, I was a pretty skinny kid. Matter of fact, the neighbors fed me. Because my dad was working all the time. And I can understand exactly his ability to take care of somebody else as defined, as demonstrated by my ability to, you know, what it would be like if I had a kid. You know, it'd be pretty well neglected. It'd be like, you know, it'd have to survive on its own a lot. So, you know, I remember one time my dad built me a room down in the basement. And one day, and we used to steal his car at night, me and my friend, forget his name right now, but we'd go out and there was a boat yard and we'd go through boats and things like this. And while I was looking at things, and we'd steal things too, I mean, things I wanted to research deeper. And so I had my whole room full of stuff. My dad walks in. We used to steal his car at night, roll it out to the street, push start it, and then we'd have to sneak it back in at night. And he seemed to not notice that, but I don't know. That's when I was about 15 or 16. And so what was your question? Oh, yeah. So people that were in my billet and I were going to be made cooks. And I loved the food. And I had had a Mika KP. And I noticed that when you're cooking the stuff and you're watching the stuff being dropped on the floor and thrown back up on the grill, you lose your taste for the really great food. So I knew I didn't want to be cooked. So I said, what do I got to do to get out of this? And they said, well, you have to talk to your career advisor. So they set me up. I went over there and the guy looks at my file and he says, well, apparently, according to your tests, and they take a whole billet of tests when you go into the service, they said you can do anything but fly a plane because of your eyes. And I said, well, what would I have to do to stay here in San Diego? And they said, well, they teach electronics here. If you could take electronics course, if you come out first of your class, you get choice of duty station plus a stripe. So I took electronics, stayed here in San Diego, then taught electronics, then got my orders for Vietnam, went over there. I ran a 16-man repair shop for electronics gear right on Da Nang airstrip. And the rockets, but once a week we'd be rocketed. They from about a mile away where another one of our bases is, Charlie Battalion, from this valley behind it, which for some reason we let them exist in, they would rocket over us, over to the other side of the air base, trying to hit the Air Force side. So it was, you had fireworks all the time. Loved Vietnam. Matter of fact, one day my time was up after a year and a half. I did an extension. I did two extensions. The colonel sent the MPs for me, and I walked out of my repair shop where I was doing a night shift on the crypto gear that flies the planes up north and drops the bombs. And I walk out, and I'm grabbed on each side by two MPs. You know, with the helmets and the striped bands on their thing. And I goes, what's up? You know, they says, Colonel says to put you on the plane and make sure you leave. I didn't even know my time's up. Most people, 99% of the people, it's like, I got so many days and so many minutes left. I mean, they know exactly when they're leaving. And I loved it over there because I was in charge. Like, what I learned about the military is if you make rank, you're in charge. If you don't make rank, you're being told what to do. But if you make rank, you're telling other people what to do. You get to run the show and make the show as nice as you want it. So you have any other questions?
Yeah. What drives you as a person, like now or any other time in your life?
Well, right. Okay. So I had a girlfriend that, glommed onto me and insisted on living with me. And finally, you know, I used to think she was just crazy. She told me the story about being thrown off a horse, dropped on her head on a rock by a motorcyclist scaring the horse. And I always thought it was just something she made up. And then one day she said, I got to go see my attorney. And I'm going, really? You know, like I totally disbelieving her. And I said, can I go with? So I drove her there and we meet this guy. And this guy is... she says, could you tell him about my case? And I asked him, I don't know. Anyways, he starts off telling me about some other case. He doesn't even know what her case is about. And then I goes, excuse me, I thought this was something about a horse and a motorcycle. And he goes, oh, Christina, I'm sorry, Christina, you know. So then he tells me about her case. It's like 4.5 years down the pike on a 5-year statute of limitations case. He's compiled all kinds of interviews with witnesses, most of whom have now died, and like time's running out. So I fire this guy. I get another attorney, he drops the ball. I get another attorney. He finally gets her. He got her a $25,000 settlement within a couple of weeks, of which she got like, I think she got 13, then he. Filed up, and I said, well, what can she do from here? And he says, look, this case was worth about $300,000. I was just starting into it, this thing, and it's back when $300,000 was something. And she needs to get another attorney and come back and sue me and her prior two attorneys. And she needs to go get one from at least as far away as San Francisco. And I says, well, how about L.A.? Because I'm going, you know, I'm not sure we can afford the phone bill and especially flying an attorney back and forth from San Francisco. He says, you might be able to find an attorney or a law firm to represent you against an attorney in San Diego, in LA. You might be able to find a law firm that will take the case, but they will sell you out. Well, I ended up getting a law firm from LA, and they did attempt to sell her out. But anyway, I got around that. But anyways, one day I'm in a bar in a neighborhood here called the Backstretch, and a bunch of people walk in, and the last person that walks in stops at my table, which was near the door, and she says, because I'm the class valedictorian, I'm obligated to inform the patrons here that this is the Cal Western Law School graduating class of 1984. And I says, funny you should stop at my table, because my goal in life is to buy a bulletproof building, set up a law firm specializing in suing you people for malpracticing against your own clients. And this was only a part of the graduating class. It was like about 20 of them. And the whole class turns around. Apparently she went over and told them what I said. I went back to eating my Brailer burger. They turn around, and one of the spokesmen, who they assume is Bobby, one of the people, Bobby, offered free beers to everyone who came with him to have the party at his place, his bar. Turns around and says, well, what's your problem? I said, well, the problem isn't that some of you will malpractice against your own client. The problem is that none of you will represent a citizen malpracticed against by one of your kind. And they all cracked up laughing. They stopped laughing. I said, so what's so funny? They said, well, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a plumber. He says, well, don't you screw your clients? I says, no, I don't, but I agree, you know, plumbers, generally contractors, misrepresent just about everything, how the complexity, what it's going to cost, what the materials are, you know. And he says, well, why shouldn't we? I says, well, perhaps you recall that you have a fiduciary responsibility to your clients, and your quasi-government licensed agents, officers of the court. And they said, well, we have as much right as anybody else in business to malpractice against our own clients. This is a just graduated Cal Western Law School laws class. And I said, well, I said, I see I've made a big mistake, because I thought some of you were holes. But it's apparently you all are. And I'll tell you right now, any of you ever malpracticed against me, I'll take you in your little one-act playrooms and I'll personally kick your butts. And so that's kind of, and so they crack up laughing again. And I said, what's so funny? They said, well, not in San Diego you won't. And I said, why not? And they said, because no San Diego judge will find against any San Diego attorney for malpracticing against his own client. And I said, where do you get that? And they went, who do you think our instructors are? So that has set me off in what is, the rest of my life has now been taken off, having been provided frauds conducted against me and going to court and finding that judges will violate all the conditions of their authority, the Bill of Rights, due process in the Constitution, and they'll do it openly, knowing you record it, knowing you document it. They don't care because they know you're not going to be able to get an attorney to represent you. So I always represent myself. So the system's totally crooked, and what I'm trying to get the government to do right now is put cameras in the courtroom. If they put cameras in the courtroom, I've been to Obama, I've been to Bernie, I've been to Clinton, I actually go to Washington, I flew to Vermont, I've driven twice up to Sacramento and met with Governor Brown's right-hand man across the hall from him. I want them to put in cameras to document. And I want one on the judge to document all verbal and nonverbal communications, because right now I contend, based on my experience with the public, that we are 98.3%. I actually argued this in court. We're 98.3% genetically chimpanzees, and we have a lot of, according to my theory, is we have a lot of built-in automated responses to certain social situations, especially when in the presence of an alpha. And I'm saying that when we were amoebas in the ocean, the very first program necessary to survive was to fear authority, to avoid authority if possible, and to abide by whatever its leanings are. And I'm saying right now, once a judge shows a leaning, the jury just seems to actually ignore any evidence presented which is contrary to the leaning he has demonstrated. So we put cameras in the courtrooms. The judges will stop doing that. The prosecutors will stop doing that. Attorneys will stop taking advantage of these nonverbal authoritarian communications. They can, and these are nonverbal, so they're not recorded on the current transcripts. We need a video record. So anyway, that's what my life has been now consumed getting accomplished.
Like, what sacrifices have you made to pursue your personal beliefs about, like, the law system, political?
Well, this place has made it possible for me to have the time, and I can understand why it's been left to me. Most people have, their life is consumed with making a living and then socializing. And this place has allowed me the money to be able to fly to Washington, to fly to Vermont, take the time. I do stand-ups at two different places here in town where I basically I'm testing the public's response to being made aware of how crooked it is. And basically it is, if they haven't been screwed in court, they really have no interest. So
sort of a niche of people that you'll be able to.
Now I've done plumbing, electric. I used to have a when I lived in Linda Vista. Now, the way I made my wealth, in college here, I took business, and I, on my VA financing after I got out, I took business law, and then I took real estate, and one of the courses I took was real estate law. But really early on, I figured out that if you take a property that you can obtain for 10% down and increase the value of that and sell it for 10% more, you double your money. So if you can double your money, you can't do that in the stock market. That's the way to go. So I bought a house in Linda Vista for $22,000, sold it in a year and a half for $44,000, traded up to the place right next to the Eagles Club, took $35,000 of that, traded up to that. Of course, then we ran into problems because my girlfriend used her money to get into drugs. I had to get rid of her. She sued me. You know, all you got to do is get an attorney and they'll go, you want their money here? Let me tell you how to get it. This is what you got to say happened. It's just such a con game. And it's all because the courts are crooked that they can get away with this stuff. So sold that. Went back to plumbing, didn't have a pot to pee in, but was renting from the guy I sold that property to, had gone through that money, was actually changing washers and doing electrical work for this guy that owned this property. And one day he said, from now on you'll be sending me bills for any repairs I have you do here up north. And he was moving. I said, are you thinking of selling this place? So he says, yeah. He says, we're looking into selling it, or I'm looking into selling it. And I said, well, you have any idea what you're going to be asking for? And he said, well, I've made some discreet inquiries. And as soon as he said that, I know he had asked a real estate agent, okay? In other words, he hadn't done a market research, which you can do just online by sales. And he said, I've made a discreet inquiry. And I thought, oh man, he talked to a real estate agent that's going to want this beautiful property for himself. And he says, so apparently it's worth about $300,000. And so I said, any chance I could get, you haven't listed it yet? He said, no. I said, any chance you'd give me like 2 weeks to see if I could put together a partnership to buy this place? And he says, yeah, sure, no problem. So I go to another one of my customers who was very wealthy. And who had worked for her family for years and years, And I wrote her what I call the Brailer business contract. What I did is I made her sign a piece of paper that said, we will, what, you know, in other words, I said, I have a business opportunity I'd like to present you, but I can't present it to you without having a previous agreement as to what we can do, we or and or you can do with this opportunity, because you could just take this and do it yourself, or you could just tell a friend about it, and this opportunity is going to go away. So you need to sign this paper. And what it said is, if we do this project, in other words, I told her it was a real estate project, but I didn't tell her where it was. We're going to do it one of two ways. Either you are going to come in with me as a partner, because I didn't have cash and I didn't have credit. Okay, she had a lot of cash, a lot of credit. I says, and one half of whatever the down payment is will be my finder's fee. So that the down payment, the down money we put in, we'll be putting in equal amounts. That turned out to be like $25,000. So, or you can come in, you will come in as my partner for purposes of qualifying for the loan. I will do the whole project, sell it in a year and a half, and double your money for you. In other words, the 25, we didn't know what the amount would be yet. Turned out to be, I would give you 50. It would be 50 in a year, in a year and a half. Okay, so she signed that, the agreements to do it either of those two ways, and then I showed her the property, and she went, ask him if he'll take 285. So I asked him, he said, sure. And she says, well, ask him if he'll take 275. And I says, Mary, this is a customer of mine, like you're a customer of mine, and I don't screw my customers, and we both know this is worth more than $300,000. The only way I'm going to do that is if we make a signed offer to purchase, and you fly me up north, and I hand deliver it. I'm not going to do something like that over the phone. It's just so fucking, I mean, that's so, you just don't do business that way. So we did that. He agreed. We bought it for $275,000. I went through the whole place, remodeled each of the units, upped the rents. And I think the rents when I first got this place were something like, I don't know, that some of the rents were under $500. And now they're, I think the smallest rents are like $2,500. And I think yours is like $3,000, isn't it? Yeah. Which I could have never, Steve raised the rents. Steve's the guy that, because what happened is due to my political stuff, I had gotten to the point where I was ignoring the business. I wasn't making my mortgage payments. Didn't even realize I wasn't making the payments. I had been refusing to pay federal tax and state tax for years, trying to get them to bring me into tax court where I could present my evidence that the government is so corrupt that it doesn't have authority to collect taxes. They wouldn't let me do that, so they pressed for sale of the property. And Steve stepped in and went, John, you're totally blowing it. I'm going to take over. He went and paid my back taxes, figured out my taxes, paid them, got them reduced, recovered the property, you know, basically saved my butt. So that's why he now totally runs the show. You know, because there's no way he would let me run a show that he's involved in. So anyway, that's this place, the income from that. Steve literally collects my mail, pays the bills, feeds me these wonderful three-course dinners. You know, I have like nothing to do but my political stuff.
Pursue your dreams.
Yeah. It's like pursuing getting this done. So I've, you know, I've tried to get Brown to do it, Bernie to do it, Obama to do it. My latest thing is I've gone to Sacramento. I went up to Washington, went into Senator Feinstein's office, and Senator Feinstein is the head of the Democratic half of the what's known as the Senate Judiciary Committee. What it is, it's a Senate committee. With the responsibility of oversight of the judiciary, and I have provided her a what needs to be done, and a movies that I've made, a composite for my stand-ups at Lestat's, where I review what's already up on YouTube under the Judicial Racketeering Enterprise, which is the actual case I submitted on DVDs in an argument. I had a ticket for failure to show proof of insurance, and I had been through other traffic tickets. I used to get a lot of traffic tickets. And I, each time I'd go in there and I would argue these conflicts that the court was corrupt and could not try me for whatever traffic ticket I was going in on. And they just blow you off. So what I did on this ticket is I bought video equipment and video interviewed myself on all these things the courts had done, showing the evidence they concealed and the evidence they ignored and all that. Put it on in the DVDs. So when I went into court on the failure to show proof of insurance, I had a documentary that the courts are so corrupt that they don't have any authority to try anybody for anything, and they dismissed the case because I showed them that, you know, they were totally corrupt and have no authority over anybody. So now I've taken that video and given that to Governor Brown, Obama, Bernie, and made other videos, even shorter videos of that stuff. But my last experience is they tried to, I got a ticket for delaying an officer while I was trying to protect my property from a fraud the city was engaged in the way they were repaving the street. They charged me with a couple of things, but what they ended up trying me for was delaying an officer. And in that, the head of the court, Judge Gill, who personally knew all the judges I sued, in 1993, I sued six judges for racketeering in the federal court. And this guy's at, so they give me, this judge who takes the case is the judge who personally, because he's 80 years old, still knows all the judges I sued way back when, and is trying to persecute me, and violates, conceals all my evidence, totally aids and abets this fraud against me, totally puts the, I mean, I couldn't have written a better script for a movie than what he ends up writing for me. I bought the transcript of that trial for $2,000, and then what nobody does, because the you know, I went to pick up my transcript, paid the $2,000, I think it was $2,200. It was a 4-day jury trial for delaying an officer 17 minutes, and for which I was fined $11,750. When the maximum for what I was tried for was $1,000, and delaying an officer, and I asked the judge, I says, gee whiz, cost of jury trial's gone up that much? And he goes, this is let you know, Mr. Braille, there are consequences for what you do. In other words, what he did is he documented that what they tried me for is what I do, not what I was being tried for. In other words, the court is just, it's a joke. So, where was I? So what I'm currently doing is trying to get Senator Feinstein, the head of the Democratic half of the Senate Judiciary Committees, who at the time was questioning Kavanaugh, the new Supreme Court justice appointee or whatever, and I went there and gave her a movie, and I gave her a list of questions I wanted her to ask Kavanaugh. I wanted her to ask him, does your oath, the oath of office you will be taking, mean that you will abide by and ensure adherence to the conditions of your authority, the Bill of Rights in the Constitution? And if he answers yes, which he would you take, will you take that oath if we require, add that to your oath? In other words, will you take an oath that says, I will abide by and assure adherence to the conditions of my authority, the Bill of Rights in the Constitution? I wanted her to ask that in the public, to educate all the people who have taken this oath of office to uphold the Constitution, which means nothing. to them. They don't know. You know, how would you define that? You could take them into court and say you violated these rights, and you go, well, you know, there's other things in the Constitution I was upholding. No, the conditions of the authority are that you provide due process and the Bill of Rights items. The rest of it is just an instruction sheet on how to set up the various branches of the government and duties. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Very well. Thank you so much for your time.
You have any other questions?
Not at the moment. Thank you very much, John.
All right.
Yeah, that was John Brailer interviewing.
The Judge Buster.